Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day with interesting stories from around the world. Today we have a story about China's unpredictable economy. Then we will hear some ideas about how the oceans might change as they get warmer. Finally, information about a new way some Africans are making electricity. Let's get started with part one. Investors have been closely watching recent sharp changes in share prices on China's stock market. Some investors say the wild movements have intensified because of concerns about the truthfulness of that nation's economic reports. Critics say the reports can fool investors by presenting an unrealistically strong picture of the economy. China is the world's second largest economy, a huge trading nation and major importer of everything from machinery to oil and other natural resources. For this reason, its economic problems affect trading partners and stock markets around the world. Stock prices in Shanghai and overseas markets have been in the news, in part because of fears that China's economy is not growing as fast as some investors expect. Weakness worries investors, and when many frightened investors sell stocks, it drives down prices. The fears intensify when financial experts worry that China's economy is weaker than the official reports show. Ben Willis is a trader on the New York Stock Exchange.
The Chinese economy, we thought, was growing at 7%. It's probably only growing at half that. So a 50% reduction, you need to reprice, and that's what you're seeing going on in the stock markets and in the commodity markets.
Expansion of major industries was part of economic growth in China. Nick Lardy is an expert on the Chinese economy. He works for the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C. He says China is better than most developing economies at measuring industrial production, especially from state-owned businesses. But he says much of the economic growth is now coming from the service industry, which is made up largely of smaller private companies.
Everything from retail and wholesale, restaurants, hotels, financial services, including banking, insurance, securities, asset management.
Nick Lardy says restaurants are a good example of the growing services sector.
When I first went to China, there were practically no restaurants. Now you go to China, there are millions and millions of restaurants. So collecting the data on all these small firms in the restaurant business is very, very labor intensive.
He adds that better, more detailed records would help Chinese leaders make better informed decisions on economic issues. But he says the group of workers collecting economic data in China is very small in comparison to the size of its huge, fast-changing economy.
You are listening to VOA. Warming oceans will cause big changes in the biodiversity of sea life. That is a finding from the largest study ever of marine plants and animals. As we hear from Bob Doty, these predictions are a call to protect the oceans and the food they provide.
The study was done at the University of Queensland in Australia. It examined nearly 13,000 plant and animal species across the Earth's oceans. Scientists used a model that looked at temperature changes at the sea surface. They then compared that information with what kind of climate and environment is best for the different marine species. The study found that warmer ocean climates will suffer species loss, but creatures in colder climates will be able to survive by expanding their territory. That is not always a good thing, says John Pandolfi. He is with the ARC Center of Excellence for Coral Reef Studies at Australia's University of Queensland.
So instead of having discrete differentiation of different marine communities in different places, we found in our analysis that projected climate change is going to result in a lot more mixing of species and a lot more sameness of diversity throughout the world's oceans.
The study lists these changes through the year 2100. Mr. Pandolfi says that sameness in the ocean is problematic as researchers consider new ways to meet the food demands of a growing human population.
It could be that species that were very abundant in the past and they're good at tracking environments, when they invade a new ecosystem or a new geographic region, they're not the top dogs anymore, or they might not be able to reproduce as effectively as they used to.
The study also looks at greenhouse gases, pollution linked to rising temperatures. Unless such gases are controlled, our planet and its oceans will continue to heat up, releasing the changes predicted in the study. John Pandolfi warns the new combinations of marine species will present a major test for efforts to protect sea creatures. In the warmer ocean climates, plant and animal species will cross into new territories. Mr. Pandolfi says the study demonstrates the importance of cooperation among nations to fight climate change and the possible loss of biodiversity. The findings were published in the journal Nature Climate Change. I'm Bob Doty.
In 2013, President Barack Obama launched a campaign called the Power Africa Initiative. Its goal is to increase the availability of electric power in African countries south of the Sahara Desert. Millions of people there are unable to depend on reliable power supplies. The American-supported program is providing money for a number of projects, including one that creates electricity from human waste. Mukuru Kwa Njenga is the name of a community close to Nairobi, where about 100,000 people live. Many of them are poor. Until recently, most did not have electricity. Those who did had illegal connections to power lines. Amos Nguru had the idea for Afrosol Energy, a project that produces electricity from human waste. 2 years ago, Mr. Nguru received an offer of financial support from the Power Africa Initiative. The money came from General Electric and the United States African Development Foundation. The project now produces 15 kilowatts of electricity. That is enough to power a nearby school and serve the local neighborhood. Mr. Nguru says his project meets the needs of the community. Deborah Imwandagina is deputy head teacher of the local primary school. She says in the past, there were too many illegal connections to her school's power supply. She says this resulted in higher costs for the school, so it decided to stop using electricity. She says, "We have been having challenges from the slums, and time and again they hack our power systems, and they connect illegally to their homes. We have been having such kind of challenges, so we just decided we cannot live with electricity. It can't do us any good, so we decided to disconnect. But now the school is once again using electricity from Afrosol Energy." Doreen Kamanto is a student at the school. Her mother, Beatrice Ochanga, says darkness no longer limits the time when Doreen can study. She says Before the electricity was there, our children could not be able to learn, since they could not come to school that early and leave that late, because the school was very dark, and they could not be able to learn. The World Bank says only 23% of Kenyans have access to electricity. And that's As It Is for today.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. Many people are concerned about signs of weakness in the Chinese economy. They want to know how these changes will affect economic activity in the rest of the world. The group of 20 major economies are holding talks in Turkey at the end of this week. American and Japanese officials want financial leaders and central bankers to make China's economy a central issue at the G20 meetings. On Tuesday, Japan's finance minister called for a frank debate at the G20 about what is happening in the Chinese economy. And a U.S. official speaking before the meeting called on China's government to carefully communicate its policy intentions and actions to financial markets. Falling stock prices have shown that investors are very concerned. Many believe that a weak Chinese economy will affect other markets. On Tuesday, China's official manufacturing index fell to its lowest level in 3 years. Leading measures of stock values dropped in East Asia, Europe, and the United States. The world's financial leaders are watching. International Monetary Fund Chief Christine Lagarde spoke during a visit to Indonesia. She said rapid changes in stock prices show concerns that economic uncertainty could spread. What has been demonstrated in the last few weeks, she said, is how much Asia is at the core of the global economy, and how much disruptions occurring in one market in Asia can actually spill over to the rest of the world. Asia is not the only area that could be affected. Experts note that China's problems could hurt manufacturing in Germany, Europe's largest economy. Experts note that Chinese reform efforts have been uneven and present different problems for China's trading partners. Scott Kennedy is with the Centers for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. He says China's economy is changing.
The Chinese economy is gradually shifting from one that is primarily based on industry and fixed asset investment to one where services and individual consumption are much more important.
But he adds that issues like reducing debt and reforming state-owned businesses may hold back the economy.
And if China's industrial economy doesn't find a way to absorb the debt that it's built up, the deleverage, reform state-owned enterprises, that's going to keep China's economy from growing rapidly.
Mr. Kennedy says the economic slowdown in China is affecting two groups of countries. The first group provides raw, unprocessed materials to China. The other group includes Southeast Asia and countries that are trade competitors of China. They are affected by the devaluation of China's currency. It makes Chinese exports less costly and reduces the value of the country's money. And that's the Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. In 1801, America had a new president, Thomas Jefferson from the state of Virginia. Jefferson had already done much for his country. He wrote the Declaration of Independence in 1776. He served as America's first ambassador to France and the first Secretary of State. Now he would govern the nation. Thomas Jefferson was happy and hopeful as he took office. His new political party, the Republicans, had defeated the older Federalist Party. The Federalists had controlled the cabinet and the Congress during President George Washington's two terms. George Washington was not a Federalist, but America's second president, John Adams, was. Altogether, the Federalists had been in power for 12 years. The Federalists and the Republicans held very different opinions about how to govern the nation. The Federalists feared that Jefferson and his followers would destroy the social order of the new country, and Jefferson's Republican Party feared that the Federalists would put power in the hands of a few elite people.
The fears of neither side were really justified, but it was a remarkable moment because the election of 1800 was extremely partisan, but it was also the first occasion in which power was exchanged from one party to another without any kind of violence or a revolution.
Andrew O'Shaughnessy directs an international center for Jefferson studies at Thomas Jefferson's home called Monticello. He says emotions between the Federalists and the Republicans were still strong when Jefferson took office. But in his inaugural address, the new president extended the hand of peace and friendship to the Federalists. In his words, "We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists." The leader of the Federalist Party, Alexander Hamilton, did not accept Jefferson's offer of friendship. As Jefferson became president, Hamilton made a speech attacking him. Hamilton had decided to continue fighting the Democratic movement in the United States. But Hamilton's opposition did not worry Jefferson. "Of course," he said, "the top leaders of the Federalists, men like Hamilton, could never be changed. He was more interested in bringing their followers to his side. He was sure he could show even the Federalists that his program was good for all." In fact, Andrew O'Shaughnessy says, Jefferson expected the Federalist Party just to disappear. He says, "People in Jefferson's time did not think a two-party system was essential to democracy.
They thought if people acted in a public spirit and put aside their own self-interest, that they would all recognize the common good and act together."
And he says, Jefferson believed his party, the Republicans, represented the true spirit of the American Revolution. In those early days of 1801, Jefferson said, "We can no longer say that there is nothing new under the sun. What we have done in this country is all new. The force of public opinion is new. But the most important and pleasing newness is that we have changed our government without violence. This shows a strength of American character that will give long life to our republic. We have proved that freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and freedom of thought are necessary in a healthy nation. Let men argue with each other. The arguments may become bitter, but the bitterness is just a cloud that passes, and out of the arguments will come the truth." As for the Federalist leaders, they, except for Hamilton, believed Jefferson's friendly words in his inaugural speech showed he would respect their party. George Cabot, the strongest Federalist leader in New England, usually agreed with Hamilton, but now he did not. Cabot said, "I believe that our new president wants to stay out of war. We do not have to worry any longer that he plans to join France against England. He is friendly to us and wants our help. Therefore, I am sure that he will not dismiss any of our people from their government positions." Another Federalist leader, Timothy Pickering, the Secretary of State under President Adams, said, "I am satisfied that Jefferson will not make any important changes in government policy and that he will depend for support more on us Federalists than on the Democrats." During those first few weeks of the new government, the Federalist leaders really believed that Jefferson was afraid of them. They believed that he had surrendered to them and would be destroyed as the leader of the Republican Party. One Federalist wrote, "Soon Jefferson will feel the bite of his dirty Democrats when they attack him." Jefferson soon did hear complaints from Republican leaders who felt he was being too kind to the Federalists. William Giles, a Jeffersonian leader in Virginia, wrote, "Of course I am very pleased by the president's inaugural speech. The president's program is correct. It agrees with the opinions of the people. But I still think that the president's success will depend on how he carries out his program. Let him offer friendship to the Federalists, but he must not permit friendship to become weakness. His friends believe that the first thing he must do is to clean out the executive branch of the government. He must dismiss from office all men who are enemies of the Republican program." Even James Monroe wrote a strong letter to the president, "Your speech and your program are healthy and good, but there are serious dangers ahead of you. There are two parties in this country, not one. One of these parties, the Federalists, has controlled the government for 12 years and has hurt our nation greatly. Some of these Federalists now speak softly to you and promise their support. But you must remember, too, that there are thousands of good Republicans who have always supported you. If you keep Federalists in office, if you appoint Federalists to office, many of these good Republicans will stop believing in you. Certainly, there is no reason why you should give jobs to men who worked for the Federalist government of John Adams. Certainly, you must throw out the officials of the last government who stole money and sold their services. Do this, and you will give strength to our Republican movement. Please understand me. I am speaking only of high offices. I do not ask that you dismiss small officials because they are Federalists. They have a right to their political beliefs. Let them keep their jobs. This will show that you are a president who can accept different political opinions. As Federalists and Republican leaders kept asking Jefferson for positions in the government, the president was thinking of his cabinet. He quickly decided who would be his Secretary of State and Secretary of the Treasury. James Madison of Virginia, Jefferson's old friend and the father of the Constitution, would be Secretary of State. For Secretary of the Treasury, Jefferson chose Albert Gallatin of Pennsylvania, the brilliant leader of the Republicans in Congress. Gallatin understood economics and finance as well as Alexander Hamilton did. For the War Department, Jefferson turned to General Henry Dearborn of New England. Jefferson's first choice to be Secretary of the Navy was Judge Robert Livingston, the great lawyer from New York. But Judge Livingston rejected this position. Jefferson finally chose Robert Smith of Baltimore, Maryland. The president had already appointed one man from New England to his cabinet, Secretary of War Dearborn. Now he turned to New England for two more appointments. Jefferson knew that the strength of the Federalist Party was greater in New England than in any other part of the country. He believed that there was no better way to move New England away from the Federalist program than to give cabinet positions to men from New England. And so, Jefferson found his attorney general in Levi Lincoln of Massachusetts. Like Dearborn, Lincoln was a patriot of the American Revolution. He had been a supporter of Jefferson from the beginning. He was famous as a lawyer in Massachusetts, where he was the top leader of the Republican Party. Jefferson turned to New England as well for the Postmaster General. It was not yet a cabinet office, but its importance was growing. The president gave this appointment to Gideon Granger, a lawyer, businessman, and writer. Granger was one of the strong Jeffersonians in the state of Connecticut. Such was Jefferson's cabinet, all strong Republicans, all completely loyal. The Federalists were shocked. Not one member of their party had been appointed. Jefferson's cabinet appointments were not the only part of his administration the Federalists objected to. That will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us each week for The Making of a Nation, our program of American history from VOA Learning English.